from the Mutual Broadcasting System. This is STRAT, Strategic Risk Assessment Talk. Now, retired Marine Intelligence Officer and globally recognized risk expert, Hal Kempfer.
Welcome to STRAT, Strategic Risk Assessment Talk. And I'm going to talk about something, it may sound a little nerdish, if you will. I'm not going to talk about what's happening with wars around the world. There's a lot happening out there. But I'm going to get into some things. We've had a recent event, the floods in Texas near San Antonio on the Guadalupe River. But prior to that, if you go back some months, we had these massive fires in Southern California where you've got estimates of anywhere from $30 to $60 billion worth of damage. I think at one time, right after the fire was done, they were saying $170 billion in damage. I was a little bit boggled with that. But even $30 to $50 billion is a phenomenal amount of damage. You have the tremendous loss of life that we saw with the Guadalupe River flash floods that took place. Just some horrific things. And every time these things happen, we go back and we look at them. And we say, well, why did we get caught off guard? Why weren't we able to more accurately predict that something like this or that this was going to happen? Why wasn't everybody better prepared? Why wasn't the warning system, early warning or whatever, why wasn't it heated? Why didn't everybody have it? Why did that early warning, you know, in case of Guadalupe River from the National Weather Service, why didn't that translate into quick action on the ground to get people out of harm's way? And we're very frustrated with that. And by the way, you can buy a new fire truck. You can build a new police station. You can build a new emergency operations center. And you can spend a lot of money. But I don't think you're going to fix those problems. All right? And this has bugged me for a long time. That money that was supposed to go to make things safer, to do proactive planning, preparedness, mitigation, to help state and local leaders say, you know, that's going to cost a lot of money to do that, but the consequences if we don't are so grave that we're going to have to suck it up. And by the way, we're going to have to make some tough decisions here because there are some things that we would really like to do that we're going to have to put on the back burner in order to be prepared for this. And it's always tough to prepare for disasters, emergencies. It's just the nature of an emergency. What is an emergency? Well, it's a situation that isn't normal. What's a disaster? Well, that's when everything that was normal is coming apart, so to speak. That's when things are being, buildings are falling down. People are being killed. You know, that's a disaster, catastrophe, emergency. All these words have kind of implied meanings that says things aren't normal right now. And it's tough when things are normal to get people to really make the investment of time, energy, money, whatever else, to prepare adequately for things that aren't normal. And it's difficult to get local politicians, state politicians, rarely. Once in a blue moon, I will see somebody elected to the legislature, to Congress, let alone that becomes a mayor or governor, who really understands emergency management, who really understands emergency preparedness. That almost never happens. The pathway to those sort of political positions is not through being a good emergency manager somewhere. The pathway is not someone who is focused on mitigation and emergency preparedness. That just really doesn't happen. So let me talk about some things with that. This was recognized, by the way. This isn't new. You know, when you look at what happened in Guadalupe, you look at Palisades, you know, we took the Palisades fire, I should say, the Guadalupe River, that we took huge hits. And we knew things were going to be bad. And yet, for some reason, we just didn't have those things in place to move people out of harm's way fast enough, to put the resources in there early enough that they could have made a difference, to do a lot of different things that could have happened. And it seems to be, you know, you go back, for example, Palisades fire, there's a reservoir up on the hill above Palisades. And of course it was down for repair. So there was no water in it. that water would have been absolutely crucial to making sure there was water pressure in the main, that they could have fought the fires. It would have made a big difference if that was there. It wasn't there. My question on that is, was that part of your planning process? Was that incorporated in November and December and early January into something, some sort of system that told us where we are, something that said, hey, by the way, this is our normal plan if there's a fire here, but because of this, we're going to have to be much more proactive. We're going to have to put more resources in there. We're going to have to do some things we don't normally do. We might have to put some big, you know, and I'm just spitballing here, some huge water bladder systems or whatever on top of the hill in order to make sure we have enough pressure in the mains to fight fires. There's a lot of things that should have, would have, could have, and of course it would have been extra cost, and you would have been making decisions to spend money on personnel, equipment, all sorts of things in a proactive manner that could take a little bit of political heat. People would say, why did you do all that and nothing happened? And that does happen. Sometimes you have major wind events in Southern California, and it doesn't turn into a major fire event. It just turns into a very windy event. And certainly there will always be those who, you know, political opponents who will be throwing darts at them saying, look at all the money they wasted for absolutely no reason. But you got to give them a decision support template, a decision support process. And this gets to my core issue, decision making. That's a big thing. And decisions are not made in a vacuum. Decisions should be part, particularly at that level, with that level of complexity and with the consequences, if you get it wrong, being so grave, those type of decisions should be part of a very deliberate process whereby it enables the decision makers to make the best decisions, to take the best course of action available at any given time. And that's what I want to talk about. There's a concept in the military. We use it, obviously, in military operations. Very, very intense decision-making environment. You know, often in a very expeditionary environment, if you will, you know, setting up somewhere out in the field in tents or whatever, you know, no nice air conditioning, not often a coffee pot with a nice good cup of coffee ready for you. Usually we're moving pretty fast, and we have a series of things that over many, many decades we put in place to make sure that we make really good operational decisions, tactical mostly operational decisions in that process. It streamlines the decision-making process. It's designed to catch all those key things that we need to know, all the factors, all the variables, and it's designed to bring in a lot of information from within our organizations and a lot of information or intelligence from without our organizations into helping design that. Now, there are variations of this in the world of emergency management. There are variations of this in the business world. I have literally flown around the globe doing things like strategic wargaming, working on strategic planning development sort of stuff for major corporations. And we find it in government. And we find that there is usually a process. A lot of times, though, when we talk about doing proactive stuff, the default button is to hit a committee. And what's the committee going to do? Have meetings. And what are these meetings going to do? It's kind of a meandering agenda where they go through these things, and it's just not the same rigor. It's not the same templated process, if you will. It's not the same discipline that you see with other things. And that's one of the reasons that in many cases, things are not where they should be. All right. But when it comes to things like disasters, floods, fires, earthquakes, tsunamis, pandemics, whatever, the stakes are extremely high. And one thing in the military is there's a cadre of highly trained, experienced, disciplined leaders who take to a process like this in a way that, frankly, their civilian counterparts don't necessarily take to quite the same way. Operational planning is a very exacting process. It's very difficult to do. We deal with it. We train with this stuff in a lot of different things. Some of it's training courses just on the planning process. And I do teach, and I have taught in those courses. Sometimes it's in professional military education. I was up to here both in learning and practical application with the Army's military decision-making process, have used the Marine Corps planning process up through general staff levels into, you know, three-star corps level type staffs. What the Army would call corps, we call it a Marine Expeditionary Force level type of things. And I've also, I did training for the Navy for their installation command for around the world with all their installations on crisis action planning. And part of that, I think, is what drove the Navy to say, we need to actually have a Navy planning process. Surprisingly, when I got into that at that time, they didn't have a distinct Navy planning process, which I found rather shocking that the Navy didn't have something like that. And then the military has things for joint service, joint planning, all sorts of stuff, joint JOPES, if you're familiar with that acronym. Anyway, a lot of things out there. Now, on the civilian side, we have the Incident Command System. ICS is the way that we are organized for emergencies and disasters. It's a way that different multidisciplinary organizations can come together across the board and put things together. And within that, we have the Incident Action Plan, or the Incident Action Planning Process, with its famous Planning P model, where it goes through. And one of the things that I did for years was I would train, and I still do, I train military audiences that work civil military things like humanitarian assistance, disaster response, all sorts of stuff like that. Basically, this is how non-governmental organizations, civilian organizations, this is how they plan. The United Nations, for example, uses that process. And this is how this ties to our various military planning processes. And this is how we can integrate our planning process into that planning process. And I kind of explain it, but there is one thing I will say, that the incident action planning process has always been one size fits all. Whether you're doing this on the hood of a fire truck or whether you're doing this in an EOC, the size of a city like Los Angeles or New York, it's still the basic planning process. One thing that is recognized in the military that has not somehow translated over well is that when you get these higher level commands, when you get these more complex type things, you need to have a different process or rigor within that process. I can take out the standard tactical five paragraph order, all right, which some of you may have heard of. And frankly, if you go to SWAT, you know, or Special Enforcement Bureau here in Los Angeles, or any of these more, you know, elite law enforcement organizations, and you say the five paragraph order, they can rattle it off just as fast as any Marine can rattle it off. That's what they use, because that's what you use. But that's a very tactical thing. That's not something where you develop and then you compare different courses of action through a very rigorous process. That's one where I sit there and I look at a variety of things. I kind of talk it through. And through what is often an informal decision process, I will come up with what I think is the best process. Now, I have done stuff where they do like mini wargaming and they incorporate that stuff in, but that's more of a SWAT type, special enforcement type thing. In many cases, you just don't see stuff like that happening in the first responder community to that degree. It's just not something they have to do all the time. They do planning in a little bit different way. Problem is, what you do on the hood of your car or what you do in a tactical situation, it changes when you get to an operational thing. It's one thing when you're looking at a house, a block, a series of blocks in an urban setting. It's another thing when you're looking at the county of Los Angeles. That's a very, very different sort of plan. And it takes a lot more going into that. Especially, you have to be able to immediately grasp what's the situation on the ground. Obviously, I want to know some things like terrain. I want to know what the terrain looks like. I want to know what roads look like. I want to know where power is. I want to know where buildings are. I want to know, you know, if I'm looking at fires, I'd like to know what time of year it is. How dry is the vegetation? What's the soil like? That was a big issue in Texas. They, at this time of year, they tend to have really hard packed soil. So when the rain hits it, it runs off really quickly instead of soaking in. And that's where you get these massive flash floods. That's a soil composition issue. All of these things are not things that your normal first responders are really trained or experienced in how to do. That tends to be a little bit more on the, more than an analytical science side, if you will, but definitely on the analytical side. And this is something that DHS tried to address some years after 9/11. You know, after 9/11, it was Al-Qaeda all day, as they say. It was terrorism. Then we had Katrina. Hurricane Katrina, we realize we are really behind the power curve on this, and we need to do much better. And with that incident action planning process, we realize there's a level of complexity that large cities, large urban areas, large government entities that are not federal, that they need to be able to do this stuff a lot better. And one of the things they need is they need an intelligence process that feeds into that. Now, when I talk about intelligence process, if you talked about like with an army brigade, they would use the term intelligence preparation of the battle space or intelligence preparation of the battlefield. More recent doctrine incorporating things like HADR, Operation Humanitarian Assistance, Disaster Relief, Civil Military Operations, they have used the term intelligence preparation of the operational environment or IPOE. That's the one that's a little more holistic in terms of what's there. That's one where I might bring in cultural factors. I will look at population density. I will look at demographic information. Do I have a greater percentage of at-risk population? Where would my at-risk population be? Like, for example, one of the things we always see with major disasters is you'll have people that live in an assisted living facility. They're not necessarily ambulatory. They're not necessarily able to evacuate themselves. We're going to have to use more resources for that. I know this sounds strange, but that is an intelligence issue. That's something I need to know in my planning process. And DHS tried to push this out there. They had comprehensive planning guidance, the same level of comprehensive planning guidance that drives other parts of the homeland security world. And it was frankly ignored. And in some cases, like in California, instead of taking the money that FEMA sent out for that, they took that money and used it to supplant state agency budgets because they had a budget crisis and they had a deficit and they needed to keep from firing people and shutting down offices and stuff. And they said, to heck with this thing that FEMA and DHS wants to do. We'd like to spend this to, renovate our facility here at a National Guard camp in Central California. Well, that's wonderful, okay? By the way, that building you renovated looks very nice. Explain that to all the people in Pacific Palisades that watched their homes get burned down. Explain that to all the people in the Eaton Fire who watched all their homes get burned down. Explain that to people in Paradise, California, you're going to have to explain it to 80 some of them pretty loud because they actually died in the fire, all right? That was money that had a purpose. That was federal funds. And it got derailed, and this never got built. And I say this now because we're still back to where we are. Now, Texas tried to do this, and the know-how to do this was actually in California. And when they called California, California was so busy trying to kind of cover up what they were doing here that they told Texas that they couldn't do it. That was a flaw in the FEMA system that allowed California to tell Texas with whom and how they could spend their federal grant funds, and hence it didn't get done. I look at what happened in the Guadalupe River, and I see a missed opportunity of a decade or more that we could have spent preparing for something like that. I'm not saying we would have saved all the lives that were down there, but if we saved half those lives, I would have considered that a major success. And I think that's actually something that can be done. That's something that we can put together. Now, if you look it up, it's called CPG 502. It's not the best written document that DHS has ever put out. I'm going to go out on a limb here and say DHS routinely puts out rather mediocre documents from a writing standpoint. The other thing is it could have been more strongly written. And I know there was a process there where they were kind of watering down certain phrases in order to make it more politically palatable for a lot of different folks. But basically, the direction was pretty clear. You need to have this process feeding into emergency operation centers. And within that, it needs to feed into in the EOCs, which are by law supposed to be using the incident command system under the National Incident Management System. They use incident action planning. And the idea was that you'd have the same type of rigor and capability feeding into that IAP process that military units have feeding into their planning processes, and that you would have much more comprehensive, much more effective, much more well thought out plans ones that can be dynamically adjusted on the fly as different factors like weather, climate, where people are at any given time, whatever. As these factors change, you can change your plan on time. In fact, if you look at some of our more elite units, they have a thing called like the Marine Expeditionary Unit, Special Operation Capable. They do a thing called Rapid Response Planning Process, R2P2. That one is based on having working a variety of scenarios on very likely plans that they'd have to execute, and then having what they call a workbook, all right, a plan in a box, if you will. And then so when they get something that's pretty close to it, they can take that out and they can adjust on the fly much more quickly. That workbook process, that R2P2 process, was something that we were working on, we were implementing here in Los Angeles County, if you want to go back 25 years ago. And after 9/11, after a period of years, the incumbent knowledge and expertise in places like LA County Sheriff's, that does its Emergency Operations Bureau, was kind of pushed aside. People had other ideas of what they wanted to do for the money, with that money. People had things they wanted to do to embellish their careers, whatever. But what we paid a price with was that we just weren't paying attention. And when that came out, that DHS guidance, there were those in LA County Sheriff's that pushed hard. And they got pushed back. There were folks that said, no, that's not what we do. And some of those folks that pushed back actually ended up going to federal penitentiary. Not on that. On some other things, which gives you kind of an idea of their character that was going on there. So I'm not saying they were crooks, but a federal court said they were crooks, all right? And the problem is that we set this stuff out, but we don't make sure it gets put in place. And that's where you end up with a Camp Mystic on the Guadalupe River. That's where you end up with something where they had a plan on the shelf that apparently nobody in the camp really knew anything about, let alone how to execute. They came in, they were inspected shortly before the flash floods took place. It says, you got a written plan, that's great. And of course, the flash flood came and that written plan floated downstream with everything else that was out there. I'm being metaphorical. I don't know if it actually floated downstream, but you get the idea. So anyway, with that said, I just want to get on my high horse because if I don't say something about this now, when would I say it? And if I don't say this, who will ever say this? You know, I kind of reminded of a poster we had in every Marine Corps office of John Wayne back in the 80s. And he was wearing his Sands of Iwo Jima Marine Corps uniform. And it said, life's tough. It's tougher if you're stupid. Well, that's kind of how I feel about intelligence support to all hazards planning. If we go into it stupid, we're going to have these major disasters. We're going to pay a phenomenal amount of money in response and recovery because we didn't put that money up front in preparedness and mitigation. And we didn't do that because we weren't making the case clear to those local decision makers that now is the time to act. Now is the time to put resources and effort in there. So anyway, that's what I want to say. By the way, thanks for listening to Strat. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for listening to me go on my little rant here, but I am very frustrated with what I've been seeing as more information comes out of Texas, and I look at all the opportunities lost there, and I'm also still very frustrated with what I saw here in Southern California, where more could have been done up front that wasn't done, and certainly there's a number of other disasters around the country where I looked at missed opportunities, and again, every time these things happen, we always go, well, why weren't we better prepared? Why weren't those people warned? Why didn't they get out of harm's way? Why? This is answering that why. This is the process. Frankly, we are better than this. We are more capable. We have the tools. There are things that we can do that most people never realize we do that well. But we have to have the political will to do it, and we have to have the pressure to do it. And so I hope that you enjoyed listening to this Strat. Please go to stratpodcast.com. You can go to my website at gripsa.com. And obviously you can go to my YouTube page, my YouTube channel, Hal Kempfer TV.